I'm Dan Smolin. I built a successful executive career in marketing and communications before becoming a top headhunter and founding my own executive search firm. Now get this, every day, mainstream media runs stories in which old school bosses and thought leaders frame your work and workplace issues in ways that are often divisive and unmeaningful. And that's just crazy. The time has come for you to answer the question, what's your work fit, so that your work and career fit who you are, how you want to live, and what you want your lasting contributions to be. What's your work fit? It answers your questions and tackles the issues that keep you up at night about advancing your career in this time of workplace revolution. So let's get started. Hey, good day, everyone. Dan Smolin from What's Your Work Fit. I hope you're having a good and successful day. Thank you so much for joining us today. We could not do this show without our live viewers and also our followers who watch us on playback and listen to us on our audio podcast as well. Thank you so much. Thank you for helping to build and scale this show, which started from a dream and is now gaining a lot of traction. We are having conversations that people have. I like to call them fever dreams. Those 2 a.m. wake me up in a cold sweat type situations that we have in work and life, often at work, that impact life. And our show today does, in fact, get into one of those kinds of dynamics, and we will get to our guests in a moment. Before we do, I have an ask, and if you haven't done so already, I ask that you engage with What's Your Work Fit. You can follow us on LinkedIn, hit that plus follow button on our What's Your Work Fit LinkedIn page. We also have a Facebook page. You can follow that. We stream as well on Facebook Live. And we also have the What's Your Work Fit YouTube page where you can subscribe to that as well. One other thing, and this is really easy, but it's super important. And that is this. If you enjoy the content and the conversation that we deliver you on What's Your Work Fit, I ask that you tell five of your friends to subscribe to us. If each of you does that, we're going to build a following, a community, if you will, for people who want to make work a wonderful part of the day, doing other wonderful things, and not the all-consuming time suck of a day, a work fit. So that's my soapbox for today. Let's get to our guest. Welcome, Dave Czarnecki. How are you?
Dan, doing great. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, you're welcome, sir. And this is going to be a real pleasure. I have been eager to get Dave on the live show for quite some time. Dave is a certified financial planner who helps career professionals and retirees make smart money decisions. It's a great gig.
Yeah, I've been doing this for quite a while, and yeah, really enjoy it. Super rewarding, and just taking people from, you know, spot A to position B, which is, you know, generally speaking, a lot better. It's very rewarding. Very much enjoy it.
Well, sounds truly rewarding. Like, you do have, in fact, a work fit in that, and you know, we will ask you about your own work fit later in the show. Dave comes to us from suburban Milwaukee, Wisconsin, where, as you can see, he's wearing a vest. You know, he's not in the summer climes where he's out in a t-shirt yet. Hopefully some of his clients are.
Okay. Yeah, just got back from Mexico. So, but yeah, back to the real world here after a short little stint on vacation with the family.
Well, very good. Well, let's get to it. Our question this week comes from our viewer, Jamal. Hey, Jamal. Jamal is about 3 years into his professional career, and he says that he has survived two rounds of recent layoffs in his fintech company. He's making a good living, doesn't spend lavishly on things he doesn't need, but Jamal worries that if he's impacted by a future layoff, that he won't have enough cash on hand to carry him until he reconnects with a new job. So, Jamal asks you, Dave, how do I financially survive a job loss? Get them started, please.
Yeah. So, I mean, it all starts with, you know, actually having a plan in place. So I think about, you know, like just what are some proactive things people could be thinking about, having contingencies in place.
Right.
You know, listen, you know, life generally speaking for most of us, you know, it's great most of the time, you know, it is sunshine and rainbows a lot of the time, but it's not always going to be. Right. So I think about, you know, if an unexpected storm were to come up, you know, like, let's give you an analogy. I'm an analogy guy. So imagine a cruise ship, you know, back in the, historically, the famous one we all remember is the Titanic. They did have some life rafts on that boat, but you know, as history, you know, as we know from history, there weren't enough for everyone on that ship. So you want to have, you've got the right number and type of life rafts. You know, now it's your financial, a financial life raft per se. So I think about, yeah, I mean, the obvious one that's already, you mentioned it already, Dan, cash on hand, liquidity, it allows you a lot of flexibility to respond to, obviously, you know, that's not going to be generating the lion's share of yield in a portfolio, but it's important right. to have that as a fallback. So certainly having liquidity in the bank, obviously, is very, very incredibly important. And then I also think about just having optionality. Think about different levers that can exist in someone's situation. I'll give you an example I've tapped into many times, a home equity line of credit. You've got equity in your property. That's a, you know, generally speaking, real estate, it would be a very illiquid asset that you, right. you can't readily sell your house for full fair market value quick. Although right now, depending on where you live, maybe you could, but, generally speaking, yeah, you don't want to have to be, uprooting your family and selling a home, but yeah, a HELOC, a home equity line of credit, that's a really common mechanism. Generally speaking, you're not having to pay any sort of fee to have it open. And then if and when you need it, you pull the lever and then you can infuse some cash into your, you know, financial life raft per se. Other lines of credit, having those set up, again, just given some optionality. And then if and when something were to come up, obviously we would hope, you know, circumstance doesn't come up where you need to pull that lever, but you've got it at your disposal. So I would say on a proactive basis, a few basic things there. It's just being prepared for the unexpected. You know, you don't want to have no optionality. That, you know, that's right. where a GoFundMe page would be your last resort.
Right.
You know, and unfortunately, yeah, like, I mean, yeah. It can come to that, but, you know, obviously when you're thinking about it proactively, that would not be a good option that you want to count on receiving a lot of money from.
So our friend Helena, is echoing a lot of these thoughts. She says, I think that cash flow is the first thing that many people worry about when they lose a job, unless they have a hefty severance package. But even then, and to your point, if you're a young person, you may not have owned property. So that HELOC may not even be a discussion point.
Right.
So for many young people, in the case of Jamal, who's only been in the job market a couple of years, 3 years, stowing away cash may be the smartest thing, especially if his company has already had 2 layoff rounds. The problem is there's no consensus now as to how much cash one should have at their disposal. When I was in recruiting, Dave, for over 20 years, people would say 6 months at least. I don't think that's actionable anymore. Why? Because we have inflation through the roof post-COVID. And also people are leaning on their credit trade lines, their revolving credit cards. So they may have credit card debt. On top of that, I don't know about Jamal, but he may have student debt. That further complicates this discussion, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And it is very circumstantial. So I'll give you a couple examples here. So, if it's a single person in a very volatile industry, maybe they're working at a startup company. That's an extreme example. It is very, very, very likely compared to like a more stable situation, maybe like a government job or a teacher where like it would be very, unless you do a terrible, terrible job and get fired, layoffs would be pretty much unheard of in those types of professions. But if it's a single person, one income in the household, in a volatile industry like a startup, FinTech, I think, was the example you gave before. That person would absolutely, they should have more than the typical person would have in a normal cash reserve. Now, if I'm working with, if I'm talking with a couple, two incomes now, so two totally separate incomes, different industries, in what we consider maybe a more stable career, should that couple still have an emergency fund? Absolutely. Everyone should have one. But I would argue the first example, the young single, one income professional, in a higher risk industry, they should absolutely have more capital, more cash on hand for the unexpected. Again, if the couple, if one person gets laid off, yeah, I mean, that would be unfortunate. We obviously, you know, that's still a circumstance that's got to be dealt with, but you still have, you know, hopefully at least half of the income coming in. So it is really circumstantial. I've had clients that, you know, feel comfortable keeping 2 or 3 years of their, you know, income in cash. I think that's an extreme example. But yeah, generally, you know, 6 to 12 months is what I typically see. It's going to vary though by someone's circumstances. And again, yeah, if it's a young person, they don't own the house yet with meaningful equity, that may not be a lever that's at their disposal. So again, if you have less options and your only option is just falling back on what you have, then yeah, certainly it would be very prudent to keep more cash, you know, hoard more money in the bank, keep it liquid, certainly.
Okay. Liquid. Makes sense because you may need it immediately. Most demand deposit accounts don't offer a yield, at least the way they did when I started in the work world when inflation was through the roof and you could get a savings account north of 6-7%. Should a young person who doesn't have equity put their cash in a money market account where maybe they get a higher yield? I mean, they can always liquidate it. It's not as, you can't take it out of the bank immediately. It may take a day or two to settle, but is that a prudent option?
Yeah, and actually I would argue, particularly when it comes to emergency funds, like you don't want it, it's actually a good thing to an extent, Dan, not being able to get the money within minutes or hours, you know, like a physical bank, I'll give you that as an example. You drive down to, you know, a BMO, a Chase, you know, one of the big banks out there. Mm-hmm. You've got, you know, there's a physical teller, you walk up to the counter, hey, I want to take out 10 grand right now. That's extremely liquid. You can get to it. And then, you know, there may be a temptation to spend that perhaps on a non-emergency type retail purchase maybe.
Yeah.
But yeah, with a, you know, a lot of accounts now, you know, like there's online high yield accounts now as an example. Mm-hmm. Like you said, yeah, you can't get that money out today. You can initiate a transfer, but it typically takes 2, 3, 4 business days to get that in checking. I would actually say that's a benefit of it, you know, because it's slightly, it's a little bit more difficult to get to.
Slows you down a little bit, makes you really think about that decision to spend it.
Exactly. Yeah. You're up on, you know, surfing the web, you know, find a flashy toy that's out there. It's a little tougher. You know, you might change your mind then before the money actually gets there that you don't actually need that toy today.
Right. So. I want to get to Stu Katz's question. So Stu's story is this. He worked in a corporate environment. And one day discovered he was out of a job. But what happened next is that people in his former department said, hey, we got work to do and nobody to do it. What do you think about being a 1099 and finishing up the project work? In Stu's case, that became a business. He became an entrepreneur and worked as an entrepreneur for over 25 years, running a video production company. In his particular case, when he freelanced after getting laid off, he did not set aside a portion of what he had earned for what was an employer portion of taxes and then got an unpleasant surprise at tax time. Can you speak to some of those dynamics, especially given the fact that some of our viewers and listeners do pivot out of full-time corporate or employee work to be their own boss, to run their own company?
Yeah. Yeah. And that question really speaks to me. So just a quick little history, walk down memory lane here. So I was in my former career, I was a corporate employee, mm-hmm. you know, so, you know, getting the W-2 income, a paycheck every 2 weeks on a recurring cadence. And then, yeah, I became an entrepreneur when I started doing this about 8 years ago. So yeah, I mean, I personally, have gone through this as well. And it is a big change. Mm-hmm. You know, when you're working for a Fortune 500 company, when you're working for, you know, frankly, any company, when you're a W-2, you know, the 6.2% FICA, you're paying that, but so is your employer. When you're on your own, you're paying 12.4. You got to pay both sides of that, that tax. And a lot of people that go from the, you know, corporate environment to freelancing going on, you know, that's how most companies start, by the way, right? It's a, you know, it's one guy or gal that starts a company, you grow it, you hire people. And then, you know, if you're successful and have a, you know, a product or service that people need, you know, you can grow it into something very large and meaningful. But yeah, typically that would be working with a tax professional. You know, typically you'd want to be paying quarterly estimated taxes as an example. And then when you, you know, come March-ish timeframe, you know, we're getting to that, you know, a lot of people, I'm getting a lot of questions from clients. Where are my tax forms? You know, we're getting to the timeline where we got to file for 23 now. Yeah, there's not a very unpleasant surprise like, oh crap, you know, I owe 10, I owe 15,000 bucks. You've got, you've been paying into that, and it's, you know, ideally you want to try to be relatively close to zero. You don't want to give a tax or an interest-free loan to the IRS. But you also you don't want to owe them a big check either and be paying penalties. So,
and I'm glad you brought up that point about you don't want to be giving free money to the IRS, because that happened to me. I, as a recruiter running my own business, I had high highs and low lows. And so there were some years where I thought I had to pay those quarterlies, and my accountant said to me, if you didn't have the cash flow to support it, one of these time frames was around the beginning of the Great Recession of 2008, 2009. And he was like, I wish you'd called me, because you paid all this money and you needed that cash. And I was like, you know, it was a difficult learning experience for me had I never run my own business before.
Yeah. And then particularly, I mean, especially after a life event, you know, if we're an easy example would be, you know, birth of a child, you know, the allowance that you should be electing on your W-4, that would typically change, you know, and then oftentimes you're over withholding. So yeah, after a change like that, great time, you know, ping the accountant, hey, you know, we had this change in the family. What adjustments would you recommend to my withholding? Yeah. Cause that happens quite a bit where, you know, people like to receive that refund check in March or April. It feels good. But when you think about it and step back, yeah, you've gave an interest-free loan to Uncle Sam, and then, you know, they paid you back, but they didn't give you any interest on that loan. So
I want to get to Carol's question. So Carol got laid off last month. I'm really sorry about that, Carol. She had been paying down her credit card balance. I don't know all the details about her. She may or may not have student loan debt on top of that. And her question is, do I hold off paying down that balance until I get a new job, or do I keep chipping away at it? Unfortunately, what she didn't tell me, because it's personal information, is how big a nut is she trying to pay down? Is it manageable? Is it like less than $2,000, or is it like a lot of people north of $25,000? And I don't know the answer to that. But let's just assume it's manageable. Let's assume in Carol's case, it is manageable. And let's say she has less than $2,000 outstanding. And also considering the fact that credit card fees, again, after the pandemic, just like food prices, have gone crazy. So if you don't pay off your balance, you might get hit with $70, $80, $90 in interest charges just for a month. What are your thoughts?
Yeah. So with a lot of these questions, my answer, you know, in quotes, it depends. That would be how it, you know, it does truly vary. You know, the answer, the recommendation would vary significantly depending on the other facts in the case. But yeah, I mean, if we don't want to deplete cash down to zero. So we do want to keep, you know, in the circumstance, probably not going to be able to maintain a 6-month cash reserve, but we also don't want to have $50 in the bank, and that, you know, then you're at risk of, you know, for a small transaction on recurring auto pay, then you get overdrafted, then you've got another problem. You know, you've created a further problem. So generally we'd want to keep at least a month buffer there, at a minimum. And then, yeah, with credit cards, as you said, Dan, yeah, is it 20 grand or is it 2 grand? That would be a big difference there of the magnitude. And then, you know, is 20 grand, is that significant compared to, you know, what the income used to be? You know, and there's also options like a balance transfer. You know, so for example, if we transferred, let's use an easy example, let's say it was $10,000, that was the balance. this is, you know, literally a Google search, you know, 0% APR balance transfer. That's how you find these offers. It, you know, but if credit was decent, if someone's in the, you know, mid to low 700s that has okay to good credit, yeah. That's typically an option. And then, yeah, I mean, a 0% APR, all it is the new company, you're opening up essentially a new line of credit that the balance is getting paid off from the, you know, maybe it's a 17 or even a 20 some percent APR, which, you know, as you said, like some of these cards are pretty ridiculous on the APR that you're paying. The interest can add up to be thousands of bucks a year. Yeah, that might be an option, a balance transfer. You would typically pay 3 or 4%, you know, so now you've got a $10,000, $300, or $400 balance at the new company, but it buys you time. You might have an 18 or 12 month time frame,
right,
before like the interest really kicks in. So it's not ideal, but it's a way to buy yourself time and then not pay 17 or 23%. You just pay 3 or 4% once.
I think one challenge that younger members of the workforce, particularly millennials, and I would gather some of the older Gen Zers have, is for the time that they were in the workplace pre-pandemic, interest rates were very, very low. And I was just mentioning this to my wife, you know, four of the cars that we bought had zero interest. And then I had to go buy a used car for my daughter and it was not zero interest. So the dynamics of finance have changed in a way that I think has been jarring to a lot of young people, because it was easy until it wasn't. So my question to you is about the easy part. You mentioned auto pay, which is a great way. If you got enough cash in your balance, it's fine. It's easy peasy. Given the threats that we have now in the workplace and where somebody might be at risk to getting laid off, does it make more sense to shut off the auto pay and set up a calendar in your iPhone to remind you when things are due, so that you don't have that Tesla on autopilot anymore. You're actually at the yoke, you know, you're at the wheel and you're driving the vehicle, so that you're making more strategic, more mindful decisions about what you're spending and when to get you through the month. What are your thoughts?
Yeah. So I personally, just like in my own personal finances for my wife and kids, I'm a big fan of auto pay. I know personally when you've got too many things going on, you've got kids sports.
Yeah.
I would very quickly forget there'd be a bill that would be overdue and I'm going to get charged interest. So personally, that's my preference. Now, I think just to expand on this further, in many cases, like particularly like with auto insurance, your homeowners mm-hmm. insurance, if you pay it, you know, sometimes it's semi-annually, sometimes it's annually. You typically save money compared to paying it monthly. But, you know, then like you said, you have to have a reminder every 6 months or every year to pay that, you know, you need the money when that bill comes due. So in that case, I think about self-escrowing. So, you know, much like you would do with a mortgage, right? You know, right. Like if you're a young person, you start a mortgage, many lenders require it. They force you to, even if you don't want to escrow your property taxes and property insurance, they force you to do that. At some point, maybe they're willing to remove it. But I like to expand on that concept with many other parts mm-hmm. of our own finance. So, for example, let's say your homeowner's premium, you know, you could pay $250 a month, which would be $3,000 a year. But your company says, hey, if you pay this annually, you only have to pay $2,800 or $2,900. You just save yourself a couple $100.
Mm-hmm.
In that case, you know, that person, you know, let's say they wanted to switch to an annual pay. The way to just plan for that, make sure you got the capital to pay the premium, you just self-escrow 1/12 of that payment.
Yeah.
You have your, you know, your annual pay cadence. You're basically paying, you're prepaying that.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have a, you know, I love the concept of having more than one checking and savings account, the concept of bucketing or tranching your money tied to specific goals or purchases. This is an extreme example. I have a couple clients that have, you know, 10, 12, 13 different, I don't think you need that many, to be honest. I think that's too much, but, you tranche out the money. And then when the goal comes due, it could be a goal, like a vacation. It could be mm-hmm. a bill, like, there could be a meaningful tax bill. You know, if you own an expensive property, it might be a 20 or 30 grand property tax bill every year. You've got the money in hand to pay for that. So yeah, any very short-term bills or goals, I do recommend you tranche those out, have them in their own separate cash account. Don't if you mingle everything with an emergency fund, the money gets lost. It's very difficult to keep track of what was this dollar for, what was that dollar for. It gets lost very quickly.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. We set up a discretionary demand checking account. So discretionary is what it is. It says I will use this money for something other than, you know, my necessities. The really nice thing is that if it's in the same institution, you link them together and you can transfer money immediately, which is nice. And that's helped me sleep nights quite a bit. I want to expand out the discussion a little bit and get to Arlie, who very basic, you know, what question should my spouse and I think up before sitting down with somebody like Dave to sort of plan out our financial future? Now, I would imagine there are basic questions, but probably some that are life stage related. The questions that a 30-year-old personal finance investor will have are going to be different than probably somebody who's 40 at the pinnacle of their career, probably different from somebody who's like in their late 50s or early 60s nearing retirement. And then, of course, somebody who might be staring down long-term healthcare requirements. How do you help Arlie to think about the questions that she should be asking somebody like you when you sit down with them?
Yeah. Arlie, thanks. Yeah. Great question. For me, it's all about having a vision. Like ultimately, like what are your goals? Like, you know, it could be a very quick conversation. I would recommend, you know, this is a several hour long conversation with the spouse ahead of a conversation, but it's, you know, what do you want to accomplish? Are there philanthropic goals you have? Is there legacy goals you have? Mm-hmm. When you retire, you know, that's different. You know, today I talk a lot more about financial independence day than retirement. You know, back in, you know, my grandparents' time frame, you know, when they were retired, it was cold turkey, right? You turn 65, the pension kicks in. Yeah. You were working yesterday, now today you're not. There's a lot more interesting retirement scenarios that are happening now. So a lot of, like, I'll give you an example. Successful couple I've been working with for several years. At 55, they want to be financially independent. They want to be in a position with their money. They can still work if they want to, because they really, really love their jobs. They love what they're doing, but they don't need the paycheck anymore. Mm-hmm. So when that happens, it gives you the flexibility. You know, you don't have to work 60 or 70 or 80 hours a week, busting your tail every week. You can, you know, maybe phase out to a part-time. You're in 20, 25, 30 hours, and you can really enjoy that tranche of time when, you know, maybe many of your peers who are not well-planned, they're still grinding it out and they're still working 60 hours a week. So just, what does that vision look like, you know, personally, professionally, and financially, you know, and I like to add philanthropically as well. Right. Just thinking about that stuff. And ultimately, one of my favorite books I've read on this topic, you know, James Clear, Atomic Habits, if you're familiar, Dan, that's he's a speaker at one of my corporate events. But ultimately, then you get microscopic with this. You have tiny daily actions, weekly, monthly actions that are going to get you to these 10, 15, 30-year goals. So for me, it starts with the vision. Have a vision of where you want to go, and then you back into the numerical stuff. You know, if I want to be financially independent by 59 and a half, 60, 62, 65, whatever the number is, it doesn't matter. Then you back into, you know, what do I, if I'm not on track to accomplish that, what do I need to actually change to get there? Maybe it's saving more, changing the investor, whatever the case may be. We can proactively have those discussions.
Now, I would imagine, Dave, that this conversation is easier if you were dealing with an individual, somebody who's not married or has dependents, but probably quite often you sit down with spouses, with couples. Now, I know you weren't trained as a social worker, but I would imagine that if the couple comes unprepared, that arguments will ensue, because money arguments in marriage are, oof, They're
tough. I believe that's the leading cause of divorce, I think, is money, if I'm not mistaken.
I think you're probably right. Now, I have not made the best money decisions in my life, but my wife and I are trying to change that. And the story that I have for you is, you know, how do you learn about money when you're a young person? You oftentimes learn it from your parents. My parents grew up in the Depression. They both took completely different lessons from their experience. My mother grew up fairly poor and could squeeze juice out of any lemon for days on end. My mother was a saver and not a thrower outer. She would save things of value, Tupperware for 45 years because it still worked. Okay, that's fine. My dad, on the other hand, was a dandy. He grew up fairly comfortably during the Depression and during the war years. My grandfather ran a very successful business. He lived in a nice house. And my father was always immaculately dressed, even when he was a teenager. So my father took a different lesson. Screw the Depression. I'm gonna live the high life and I'm gonna treat myself well. And even through his work years, his narrative was about the new car he bought. I mean, you tell me the year, I'll tell you what new car he bought. It was always, this will make me feel good. So I didn't learn about the value of the why of investing. As Oprah says, when you have money, you have choices. And I really believe that. So starting off, I went up the corporate ladder pretty quickly. I made a lot of money, but then I unfortunately took too many lessons from my father. I pampered myself. I got a nice car. I got one of the first mobile phones for my car, which, 35 years ago, boy, that was expensive. That bill was, I wrote it off as a business expense. Still, the cash flow of the things that I was involved in, I look back on that and I said, why did I do that? Why did I eat out so much during the day?
Yeah.
So I think part of the value of sitting down with you was doing the homework first to say, I've made these decisions that haven't benefited me. I would probably have a few million more in cash reserves had I not gone out to fancy dinners every week and treated myself to the movies and bought a new car every 2 years. So get us back to sitting down with a prospect or with a customer for the first time. And how do you get them to align on that common goal of creating wealth and the benefits that come out of that wealth, because it helps you get to do things that you normally would not be able to do. I know that's a heavy lift, Dave, but I wanted to tee it up.
Yeah, that is very, very good question. So yeah, the whole dichotomy, the spender versus the saver. And by the way, if most commonly I'm working with married couples with kids, and invariably the vast majority of the time I have one spender and one saver. So that's the most difficult combination. If you have two savers, that is a very easy conversation. You have two spenders, that's a little more difficult, but when you have one of each, it leads to a lot of, it's two rams butting heads. It leads to a lot of conflict. As we mentioned, just like emotionally, like, no, I want to, it's important to me to eat out 4 days a week. No, I'm cool with doing that once a month. That would be personally probably for my household is probably a good example. But yeah, it's ultimately, it's about compromise, right? So, if I'm working with a couple and one person, it's important to take four international, like big vacations, expensive vacations a year. One person, that's out of the question from the finances. Maybe we had compromise at one or two, right? So like with anything, I think with any relationship, it's about compromise, but particularly with money, you do have to find a middle ground with this stuff or neither person's going to be happy. The spender is being forced to all of a sudden save 20%. That's probably not going to sit well with him or her. And then if the saver is, was coerced to spend 50 grand a year on vacations that they don't think they can afford because they're going to have to work till 65 instead of 60 now, that's also not going to sit well. Right. So we got to find a compromise with that. It really is about, having ammunition around this, having understanding, like, in the long term, if you made a course correction, I think about like an airplane that's trying to take off a runway, you know, especially for someone that wants to retire early, maybe they're in their 40s now, that runway is starting to get shorter and shorter. So you really have to, you know, kind of internalize it and just understand, if you don't make an adjustment now, here are the long-term ramifications on that runway. It's not going to get any longer ever. You're not getting younger.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's for married couples, it really is about compromise. You got to find that middle ground, I think.
So let's talk about the life-changing pivots that we have to take. So, you know, we did a pretty good job of planning our daughter's 529 for college, and she went to a state school, and we were like, great, you know, this is a fraction of what it would have cost her or cost us if she had gone to a big name private label school. And, you know, a lot of people did that. The problem is, during the pandemic, the quality of my daughter's experience was pretty awful. You know, she didn't have that classroom experience as a result. And it wasn't just her. Her peers didn't learn. They had learning loss, even in college, because they weren't working together. They didn't have the traditional college experience. And what happened to my daughter was that the course, the field of study that she had started and was very excited at about doing when she was 18, by the time she hit 22, she was like, you know, this place has taken all the fun out of it. I don't even want to do it anymore. And then became the part of, you know, some other issues as well. She had some health impacts. So we pretty much went through all the 529 money. We thought we were going to be covered for 4 years. And now we were in a situation where we're like, okay, we got to help her figure out her next step. And I won't get into the details, but it's an exciting career opportunity, probably more akin to having career technical education, if you will, CTE, which you still need to get some sort of certification or degree, but it's less of an impact, and it could get a young person to money, to earning money very quickly, as opposed to maybe getting a graduate degree and, you know, maybe it's going to take longer. Okay, I've kind of gone off the beaten path here. But the point is that we had to sit down with our financial planner and say, okay, this is what's going on. We want to figure out a way that we can take some of what we have stashed away and give it to her. So we actually gifted her the maximum amount of money that we could for each of us, which, you know, this is and the IRS tax code, 17,000 times two, so it's 34,000. And that is enough money to cover her in her coursework for this new thing. And we're happy to do that. We love our child. And child, she's 20, going to be 24, 23 rather. But these are some of the things that even when we're younger and our kids are growing and we're intentionally socking away money in that 529, that maybe we can't foresee. Things are going to happen, Dave. So how do you prepare somebody for that? You know, if they come to you and they say, Dave, we've got to reallocate our resources and we have to set aside some money for our child who's going to do something different now.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, in the example you're giving, yeah, I mean, if mom and dad, if they have the means to do so, yeah, certainly utilizing that annual gift exclusion, which, yeah, the most recent one you're referencing was 17,000 times two for a married couple, for you and your wife. So yeah, certainly that's an option. If, you know, not everyone necessarily would have the means to do that. Now, I always like to think about, you can, you know, a child can always take a loan for their college education. Mom and dad can't necessarily, you can't really go out and get a loan for your retirement. You know, you're not going to go to the bank. Hey, I need $3 million. I didn't save enough for retirement. Can you give me a loan for that? Right. That's banks don't do that. You're not getting a loan for that. So I do like to think about, like, yeah, you know, mom and dad love, you know, the kids, of course, you want to do, you know, help them out as much as you can financially. But frankly, it's not doing that. I mean, if you can't retire, you don't have enough assets. If they're having to take care of you when you're 70 and 80, when they're 40 and 50, they got to up, you know, their entire life has to be picked up. You're not necessarily, they might thank you in the short term for paying for their college, but you're not doing them favors long term necessarily.
Right. Right.
So you really got to make sure you've got your own ducks in a row. You're well planned for, you've got your stuff ready to go. Retirement's tracking. You know, you're green on all the metrics that we like to look at. Things are looking good. Then, you know, then you can start to think about, yeah, I'll give them a full ride. Maybe I chip in. a student loan is, yeah, like ideally, yeah, we don't have any loans. That would be fantastic. But, you know, they get into a high paying industry that, you know, they may be able to pay that off pretty quickly with a student loan. So, I mean, a student loan, it's a non, you know, they can't repossess your college education, right? So it's,
no,
it's,
they can't.
It's a non-collateralized loan. They can take your house, they can take your car, but they can't extract the education from your brain. So,
so one of the things that we've tried to do with our daughter to varying degrees of success is have a what a money can do when you have it conversation. Unfortunately, sometimes she just wants to, you know, treat herself to something nice and there goes the money. But what we did do aligns with what Jeff said, which is, so when his 16-year-old son has a summer job at a sleepover camp, he's wondering, can I get him started with his own Roth IRA? And you can talk about the difference between a traditional and a Roth IRA, but this is actually something I did with our daughter. And she got to have a choice in the investment strategy. Now, we said some basic things. We're gonna get you into an index fund, S&P, you know, like a spider index fund, because that's gonna be, you know, a good starting point. But she wanted to have interest in individual stocks. We had a conversation. Okay, what would interest you? The first thing she mentioned at the time was Apple. Okay, that's doing really well as a company. She loves Apple products, so. She now has this interest that we started when she was 16, Dave. And she's like rooting for her money, her wealth build. So getting back to Jeff, I guess the question is, how do you establish that? I would imagine you can't go beyond what that child has earned in a given year. You can't max out. So is it a good way to get started? Is a Roth IRA a good vehicle? And is it better than a traditional IRA?
Yeah. I'll start with just the basic mechanic, the first question, the first part of the question. So yeah, let's just on a move forward basis. So let's ignore the limits in prior years, but yeah, in 2024, if someone's under the age of 50, the limit, you can put up to $7,000 into an IRA. So it could be Roth or traditional, like that's the limit for aggregated for both of those combined. But the limit is $7,000. That's the ceiling, but then it's going to be potentially reduced if someone's earned income is not sufficient. So it's going to be the lesser of the limit, $7,000, or if they earned something less than that. So for example, I'm a big tennis player. I used to teach tennis in the summers. I didn't make $70,000 doing that. I made a couple thousand dollars for the summer. You know, I think it was like $200 or $300 a week. Got in great shape. It was fantastic. Really enjoyed my time, built some great relationships. But yeah, that year, let's say you had $4,000 of income from a summer part-time job. The limit this year is $7,000. You're capped at your earned income for the year. Now, if you have, and a lot of people get confused, what is earned income? Yeah. That would exclude passive sources of income. So like if mom or dad started an investment account that had some earnings on it, that's passive income.
Right.
That does not count as earned income. So it has to be, you know, W-2 income you are working for. So absolutely. And then Roth versus traditional. Roth, you're contributing on an after-tax basis. So it's money you've paid income tax on once on the way in, you put money to the account. And then as long as it's what's considered a qualified distribution, generally, you know, you have to have the account open at least 5 years from your first contribution. And then you're older than 59 and a half. Roth, everything in there, the gain, you know, plus what you put in originally, you can get that money without additional income tax. A traditional works the opposite. So when you put money in, you get a deduction. There's income phase outs, by the way, on both these accounts you have to be cognizant of. You get a deduction on the way in. So the seed, the money that you've put in, that gave you the benefit up front. You're deferring all the gain. And then when you take money out, you harvest the money out of that account. You got to pay all the tax with the traditional. So generally, which one is better? I mean, it depends. Mm-hmm. But generally for a young person working a summer job, that's probably the least money they will ever earn in their career. You know, once you turn 22, you get the full-time gig. Yep. You go from making $3,000 or $4,000 to 70 or 80 or 100 or 250 or, you know, or on up if they're running the company or are a VP of the company. So generally Roth, is very smart for a young person in a low tax bracket. And then most people are going to, you know, unless tax brackets change, which, you know, one thing I know for certain is that tax brackets have, they've gone up, they've gone down, they've never stayed the same. I can't predict where they're going to go. But yeah, most people are in the, you know, somewhere between 22 and 37% federal now. It's a lot better to, when you're paying zero to very, very low tax bracket, pay that tax in the Roth, never again then.
Right, right. Dave, this has been a lot of fun. I so appreciate this. We'll get to our final question in a moment, but I want to give you the opportunity to point our viewers and listeners to where they can find you on social media, to read some of the posts that you have, but also to perhaps connect with you and have a conversation. How would they do that?
Yeah, Dan, I am, as you well know, I'm a very big guy on LinkedIn. So yeah, easiest way, search for my first and last name. I believe I'll be the first. There's a couple other folks in different industries, but I believe I'm the first person that'll pop up. I believe there's a schedule. There's a calendar link on there. And then certainly my website, you can find me online as well. Either of those, I'm happy to connect and have a chat.
Wonderful. Okay, that gets us to our final question, which is, what's your work fit, Dave? What attribute, condition, experience, place, or state of mind makes work a wonderful part of your day, doing many wonderful, meaningful things and not the all-consuming time suck of a day? What's your work fit, Dave?
Yeah, for me, what I, an enjoyable day, you know, from 8 to 4-ish on a daily basis doing what I do, is what I really enjoy about my job is when it's not monotonous. So like, you know, I wouldn't say my previous job was my not monotonous by any means, but I really, really enjoy, like, everyone's got a different story. They have different backgrounds. It's really, really fun just hearing people, you know, where people came from. That, you know, I went from a corporate gig about 8 years ago, you know, working in the cubicle, the 8 to 4. I certainly enjoyed it. It was valuable. But for me, the reason I became an advisor was, you know, just getting to meet with people face to face, whether it's on a computer screen or shaking hands in person, and just hearing their stories. It's something different every single day. I really, really enjoy that. So the breaking up the monotony, having different conversations with people all over the country, that's what I really love.
That's wonderful. This has been so much fun. I'm wondering, can we get you back on at a future point to continue this conversation?
Happy to do so, Dan.
That'd be wonderful. Thank you so much.
Take care, Dan.